once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone numbers to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
Well, I was trying to keep it positive in the first hour, but I ran out of positive news, so I'll give you some negative news.
Okay? Negative news?
Negative news.
Wait a minute. We might have people calling in if we start telling them negative news.
Yeah, that's true.
Negative news sells.
We have very... There's a couple of stories in the Wall Street Journal that I noted that follow a line. They're in the Wall Street Journal this Saturday, today, the 27th of July, follow a line that we've been kind of harping on for a long time. For example, in the city of Detroit, there are some municipal bonds that are quite healthy. And there are some municipal bonds that probably will make interesting wallpaper.
Yeah. Well, let's use the same analogy. Some of the municipal bonds are healthy, and some of the municipal bonds are not even on life support.
Right.
They have flatlined. They are worthless.
One of the things that I heard some hopeful thoughts for some people about the fact that the municipal bond holders get paid first and the pension people get paid last. Well, that's not what the administrator of the bankruptcy is planning to do. And apparently on Friday, the last lawsuits were squashed, if you will, that said, oh, you have to pay the municipal bond holders first. Well, there's an underlying story to this, and it's in the journal, and I think it's a good one, and that is people bought bonds years ago, in most cases, and they just looked at the interest rate and who issued them,
mm-hmm.
and said, that's enough. Well, the bonds that are healthy from the Detroit area may have been issued by the city of Detroit, but if they are backed by and guaranteed by the state of Michigan, they're perfectly healthy bonds, because Michigan, interestingly enough, is in excellent fiscal condition. And one of the comments by the governor earlier that the hole that is Detroit, the fiscal hole that is Detroit, would suck the whole state down if he tried to pour money into it.
Wait a minute. I thought we were talking about Detroit. Now you're talking about Michigan. I thought Detroit was in the United States.
You do an excellent job of emulating my brother, but let's not go there. Okay. Now, there's a second story that works out to the same thing, only it's instead of looking back and saying, you know, we really should have looked at that individual investment rather than simply looking at whatever is going to pay us the highest interest rate,
mm-hmm.
and it was issued by the city of Detroit. And that is ETFs today. We are very, very, very cautious in our use of ETFs.
Very much so.
And with good cause. But right now, considering the number of people who are purchasing ETFs, now it's exchange-traded funds.
There's a lot of them being used out there.
And they're, you know, they're funds, and many of them are registered as, in some ways, as sort of kind of mutual funds. But we are very cautious about them, and I'm going to remain cautious about them for probably a long time. And here's the reason why. We're seeing it appear right now, for example. A new ETF came out. It's a PowerShares ETF. And PowerShares leverage something. In other words, they borrow money in addition to doing the investing. And the PowerShares ETF that I'm referring to is one that covers the Standard & Poor's 500 Stock Index. Okay, sounds cool. And they have a wonderful history going back many years that you can get showing how well that ETF did. The problem is that the history runs back before ETFs even existed.
Yeah, there's a little problem with that.
And there's a loophole that's being exploited by the brokerage industry right now where they show the history of an exchange-traded fund, an ETF, a leveraged ETF, showing what wonderful results you would have gotten had you invested in it 10 years ago or 5 years ago or whatever. The problem is the thing they're selling, this new ETF, only came into existence this year. Now, how can they do that? It's called backtesting. In other words, they simulate or hypothesize the history of that particular investment and what would have happened if they had done what they're doing today back then. The problem with that, and it is something that really is a personal bug to me, and brokers do this a lot. A lot of times brokers don't even realize they're doing it. They just take the data they're given and they show it to people and then they sell them something. The problem with that is that the Standard Poor's 500 stock index is in fact an index, and we've talked about this before, and as people invest in that index, it changes the behavior of the index. So if we have leveraged money, that was leveraged means borrow, some of it is the money that the people invest and some of it is money that's borrowed, it's poured into the Standard Poor's 500 stock index, it's going to change the behavior of the index. It gets worse. There is no way you can go back and find out what the numbers were, how they calculated this wonderful performance in the past. Because, folks, any time that you see hypothetical performance, it's made up.
That's why they call it hypothetical.
Now, do we use that? Sure. You can only learn by studying the past.
Yeah.
But there are some accepted ways to do it that work and have worked historically.
Right. When you look at the past and you say, this is what's happened in the past, so we can reasonably assume that this is a normal characteristic of that area. But instead, if you say, what I'm going to do is I'm going to find the right stocks that worked really, really, really well in the past and say that was in my portfolio when I didn't have it. That's a different way of doing things, and we don't like that so much.
And you should be able, by the way, and this is a little rule that I have. I don't know if anybody else that puts this rule out there, but I think it's a good one. If somebody says, okay, this is a hypothetical, if you'd invested this way in the past, here's what would have happened, you should be able to go and independently verify that information without a great deal of effort.
Yep.
Now, that sounds a little crazy. Well, how could I do that? Well, it should be online and easily available.
Yeah.
And
if you, here's where the numbers are.
There should be some independent body that says this is the real thing that happened during that time period. Now, that's a very, very high standard.
If I went to a high school class, so we'll call it an advanced placement class because some high school classes are harder to deal with than others, but an advanced placement class, and I told them, I want you to put together a portfolio that over the last year made more than 10% return.
Sure.
They could say, oh, yeah, no problem. If I gave the same problem and I said, I want you to put together a portfolio that over the next year makes a 10% return and graded for the same thing, there'd
be
a very different response.
Yes.
When someone bases a portfolio based on knowledge of what's already happened, and they said, this is a hypothetical portfolio, but look how well it's done in the past. That's a problem. If you look at history and you say this type of company tends to act like this, and we're going to make generalizations for a large group of companies, and in certain situations they act like this, that is how we make decisions for the future. If you say, well, I have a portfolio over the last 10 years has done 80% a year, well, did you make any money off of it? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. If they then say, well, no, it's a hypothetical portfolio, then you say, well, there's a problem there.
And to compound that, this thing about ETFs, and again, those are exchange-traded funds, and if you get offered them, approach them with a great deal of caution, research them carefully before you even consider them. But ETFs, to compound that, recently the market moved around a little bit in May and June, and particularly towards the end of June, we had some big market moves up and down, both in the stock market and in the bond market. Well, this is the fascinating thing about those ETFs that theoretically follow an index. In a lot of cases, and this was an article we discussed a couple of weeks ago, I think, those ETFs were as much as 17% off of the underlying index price.
Right.
So the hypothetical history, when somebody offers you an ETF, assumes something, and you have to look at the assumptions very carefully. The assumption is that the ETF followed the index perfectly, which ETFs don't do. So that's one of those things that it certainly is. And there's a thread here. When interest rates were falling and the economy looked like it was in difficulty and the stock market was falling, people bought municipal bonds literally poured trillions of dollars into the bond market. And now, by the way, that money is coming out about as fast as it went in.
And they're scared now.
And a lot of the bond market is falling, and particularly the longer bonds, the higher interest rate longer bonds are falling in value. And that's another thing that came out in the articles that I read today that I tend to agree with, and that is that we're likely to see interest rates gradually rise over the next several years. As that happens, longer term and thereby higher interest bonds are going to have a tendency to fall. That is one of the great conundrums that we have in the investment management business right now, is finding something to stabilize a portfolio, because bonds tend to stabilize a portfolio. Finding something that will stabilize against a market decline without involving the portfolios in a great deal of interest rate risk. This is a big challenge right now, and those who fail that challenge will probably not have as much money as they otherwise might have had. But it's a crucial thing in today's environment to understand what you're investing in, to be able to research it, to have the transparency to see exactly what it is and dig into the stuff. And you say, well, I don't have the knowledge to do that. Either you need to get the knowledge, or you hire a professional who has the knowledge. And by that, I don't mean a stockbroker or a, quote, financial advisor, end quote.
Mm-hmm.
Because the world is becoming more complex. Like, as another example, this ETF thing I was talking about, it's a loophole that they use to put the hypothetical illustrations together.
Right.
But an unregulated brand, in other words, the parent company of the company that issues the ETF is not regulated, so it can put the stuff out, but the ETF issuer can't. The same thing is true, what we call Reg D offerings, which are non-traded in most cases. They're always non-traded. And they're private, called private placements, and they sound really sophisticated. Well, the SEC finally did what Congress has demanded they do, particularly came out of the House. It came part of the law changes several years ago. They are now allowing these companies that have what are called Reg D offerings, private stock offerings, to advertise. Folks,
that's a little scary.
That is downright scary. These things are extremely high risk.
Well, it's
and extremely poorly.
This is exactly the warnings that I heard from doctors when advertising was allowed by pharmaceuticals. And now if you turn on CNN or MSNBC or any other show or any other channel on television that has a baby boomer population that watches it, about one in three ads is going to tell you how to solve every health problem you've ever had by showing you pictures of people running on the beach and people floating in the water and splashing each other while they laugh, and telling you how you can solve your arthritis or your headache or your whatever, and then spends the second half of the ad still showing you people laughing and having fun on the beach, telling you all of the side effects that could happen as
death.
Well.
Death, dismemberment.
Yes, all the things that could happen. And the reality is that I don't have the education to know that that's the medicine that I need. And if I show up at the doctor and the doctor has 10 minutes to talk to me and I tell him this is the medicine I need because this is what I have, and the doctor says, are you sure you have that? And you say yes, and then he gives it to you. Well, that's really good for the pharmaceutical, but it's not necessarily good for your health. You need to have a good picture of what's going on. And the same is true when you're talking about, well, more even true when you're talking about research drugs. When somebody, it's a new pharmaceutical, it's not really been tested that much. It's got some documents on it, but it's in a new phase and people start advertising it. It's not even in full human trials yet, but there's advertisements out there. That's what we're talking about in the stock market when we have the Reg D advertisements being allowed. We don't know what these companies are yet. We don't, there's usually all kinds of study that's gone into it, and quiet periods where we're just, where the auditors are looking at them to make sure that the numbers are correct. If they can be advertising in the middle of all of this, it's the same as when some big pharmaceutical starts advertising a drug that it's just got under test, and that everyone should have, because all it does is it puts pressure, in the case of drugs, on the FDA to get that drug fit into production rather than making sure that it's safe. And in the case of the SEC here, it puts pressure on them from the public to make sure that that stock is released properly without any impedance, when the SEC's job is to make sure that the numbers are correct, that they are being filed, that there's not fraud being done. Anyway, that was me jumping on your soapbox and getting my feet all clean as well.
Well, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number is in here if anyone is actually listening, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
And we have some words from KTEM sponsors, lots of words, actually, several minutes worth of words. And we're going to play those, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Did that commercial in there about the power trading?
Yeah.
Did you stick that in there because of what you were talking about the little thing at the end that says...
the thing about risk?
Yeah.
Stock trading may include risk that may not be appropriate
high
for
risk,
all people.
Anyway. No. We have a caller on 773-1400, and you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Hello?
Hello.
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 That's you. Yes.
Hello. You're on the air.
That
hello.
Was, yes. You're saying hello still. Hello.
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 Can you hear us? Can you hear us now?
Now I can.
All right. You're on the air.
Go ahead.
And I've got a humdinger of a risk.
You do?
Yes. Newlyweds. And the statistics are that if they're married for 5 years, they're going to be married for a long time. However, they took over a small project of $250 for 10 or more years, and they're thinking about an insurance policy to cover it because they have nothing else to use it as a coverage. What do we use for... a lien, is an insurance policy a good lien in place of land or whatever else?
I'm not following you really well.
Right.
You say you have some newlyweds, and they have, what, do they owe money on something?
Well, the something is a bunch of loans. That is put into a loan that used to be land, but they're going to use the land to put a trailer on. If they put the trailer on it, the land would belong to the trailer and be part of the payment for the trailer instead of belonging.
Oh, well, it's part of the collateral, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
so,
well, yeah.
Would an insurance policy take the place of a collateral?
No.
And if
no.
the loan would
no.
be for 10 years, till death do us part, is it a good or a bad idea?
Well, basically, they're trying to buy a trailer house, put it on a piece of property, and then pay off the trailer house, right?
Yes. And they also owe $250 for 10 or more years in addition.
On what?
On the land?
No, in addition to
why do they own the why do they owe the $250?
Because they have borrowed for school, they have borrowed for car, they have borrowed for necessities, and they have borrowed for want.
It's really a very simple issue. They just need to make the payments, and they probably can't get the loan for the trailer, what you're trying to say is unless
without
yeah, that makes perfectly good sense because whoever loans them the money, probably there's no down payment on the trailer.
And
the issue is they've got to be able to get their money back. And the trailer, the moment those people start living in that trailer,
it becomes
worth less money. And
a
if
lot
they,
less.
And there's no assurance that the bank has or the mortgage company has that they're going to maintain that trailer well. As a matter of fact, people tend to trash trailers. That's why they're called trailer trash. And and so they need to have some means of recovering their money,
Well, her father is willing to put up the rest of the money for the trailer.
Well, that makes sense. Then loan him the money for the trailer.
But his, let's pretend, but not mother, has loaned most of this $250 times 10 years over the past 10 years.
I'm not following you, Will.
So we're pretending now that a mother has loaned the money that has that $250 a month payment for 10 years.
Yes.
Okay. I'm pretending that.
For college, for vehicles, for a multitude of
does the mother
needs and enablements.
Well.
Without alcohol. I found out that you can enable without drinking it.
That makes sense.
Right.
The point is that so that's probably not hypothetical. That means you loaned them the money, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, the bottom line to it, when you loan money to a family member,
acquaintance,
that's even worse. when you loan money, if you don't have collateral, there's a pretty fair chance you won't get the money back.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's true almost all the time.
You just need to consider that when you do it. And there's nothing that can be done beyond that. Now, and then there's no insurance policy that somebody will pay the money back.
Now, you can get an insurance policy on their life, but unless that's part of the original contract.
Yeah, but they have to die.
Yeah, unless that's part of the original contract,
right.
You can't just come in and say it now.
And most insurance companies will not pay off if you kill them.
Right. If you say, well, they weren't paying, and I have life insurance, and so I had them killed,
they frown
the police still tend to think that that's not a good thing.
But, you know, in most cases, what that means is that you get free room and board for the rest of your life.
That's true. You do have your gated community taken care
right.
of from that point forward.
But, no, it sounds like...
And if I already live in assisted living...
Well, yeah.
This would be a much more forced form of assistance.
In cases like that, I have five children, if I had to do a case like that where it was a long-term issue and I wanted to pay me so many dollars a month for many, many years, I would probably just give them the money and not worry about it.
If it's an acquaintance that you've loaned money to, then from the beginning, the idea of having collateral and having a contract is very important. If it's a verbal contract, then you've left yourself very vulnerable.
Okay. And if it's a written contract...
If it's a written contract prepared by an attorney...
What would you put in it?
Well, no, first you have to hire an attorney.
Yeah, that attorney needs to put this together for you, and if they really need the money, then they're going to be okay with signing the contract, which says that they have to pay you back.
Okay.
I think that's kind of important that you have a contract that tells them to pay you back.
We've heard many, many, many tales of woe of people who have loaned money to relatives or friends.
Or acquaintances.
And had a verbal contract, and the people didn't pay. Because it really boils down to the fact that if they run into financial difficulties, or as you said, get divorces or whatever, then people will pay the bills where somebody is threatening them with potential harm if they don't pay the bills.
And by that, we don't mean the insurance death harm. We mean like
harm,
damage.
Harm like taking something from them or making them declare bankruptcy or something. And the ones where it's friends and relatives, in most cases, they don't pay during that time period and they just don't pay at all. And the reason is you aren't going to sue them. And you don't have grounds to sue them unless you have a written contract.
Uh-huh.
And so it's just one of those things where when you loan money to friends or relatives or acquaintances, one of the things...
Everybody trusts God and we're on the same page.
Well, it's important to put it in writing. It's important to make it enforceable. And it's important to realize that you may terminate the friendship, the acquaintance, or the relationship if you go to collect it. And you have to make up your mind in advance whether you want to be what people would call cruel and actually get the money that's owed to you.
Now, at $250 a month for 10 years, that's about $30,000. It's exactly $30,000. Is that the loan that you're making, or are you charging interest on that?
To be charged interest on that of about 4%. Does that sound reasonable?
Well, it varies. It all depends. There's no such thing as reasonable or unreasonable there. But the
it
point
depends
is, again,
on the risk. The higher the risk, the higher the interest.
When you enter into a contract that has finances involved in it in any form or fashion, in my humble opinion, you need to pay an attorney.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Thanks. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. 773-1400 is the number in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400. And that's the second hour. We've only had one set of commercials.
Had one set of commercials, but we did have one telephone call.
We did,
which is really cool. I think there's, you know, continuing our negative hour. For those of you who don't follow these things, and we do, there's a company called SAC.
Yes. Named after a person, Stephen A. Cohen.
Capital Advisors LP, which for several years has gotten, well, for 20 years actually, has gotten exceptionally high returns for the investors. The largest single investor was Stephen Cohen, who now has like $20 billion.
Yes, it's a big deal. People have talked about their returns are just unbelievably good.
And, of course, now what they do is they charge 3% of the money invested each year plus 50% of the gains.
Yeah, and that also goes to Mr. Cohen.
And the problem is, for those of you who haven't followed this, that the company itself is now being charged with criminal wrongdoing.
Yeah, two traders on there are already in hot water and have
been. More than that, there's like six.
Well,
I think.
Two of them have already been found guilty. Two traders have been found guilty of insider trading.
Criminal insider
trading, where they have knowingly gotten information that the public didn't have. It's kind of like going to Vegas and paying the blackjack dealer to give you only the best cards, and everybody else at the table loses because you've paid the blackjack dealer. That's insider trading. And Stephen Cohen is now being charged civilly by the SEC for failure to supervise those two people.
Well, not just, like I said, there are four others who have, quote, flipped.
Right.
Who are admitting to criminal activity and are providing evidence now to the
And the Justice Department has now filed criminal charges against the organization, which means that it's unlikely that anybody's going to go to jail, but there's going to be a big fine there.
No, the whole issue is that it's a felony, so that means that's at least a year in prison.
What they should do is take
the entire hedge fund and put it in prison.
What they should do is take the papers, the corporate environment papers, you know, the documents of incorporation, and put them in the prison cell for a year. And that way, I've always found it a little bit funny when the Justice Department is giving criminal charges to a company, but people behind it.
Well, they couldn't. The people that they've gotten in their charging have apparently been very loyal to Mr. Cohen.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of billions, and even if they go to prison, they'll get out eventually, and theoretically, he'll take care of them.
Right.
But the reason, I was trying to figure out, why would you charge them criminally rather than civilly? It's harder to prove. The reason is there's about $10 billion in SAC right now.
Right.
At least. Maybe more. Maybe $20 billion. And if they get a criminal prosecution and they go in initially, and because they've just announced they unsealed the indictment,
right?
Once they actually get into court, it's possible to seize the entire fund under criminal charges, and just like they charged Madoff criminally, and as a result, were able to seize all the money that wasn't there. And this is the interesting part to me. I told you we were being negative this hour, in a very cruel sort of way. A lot of people don't realize that if a person had invested in Madoff's funds and gotten out early before they blew up, and as a result made a lot of money, because Madoff was paying people a lot of money, obviously.
Just like, I mean, SAC's been paying a lot of money out there.
That now the bankruptcy trustee and the courts are going to those people and saying, give all that money back because we're going to divide it equitably among everybody. Apparently, all these people who over the years have made tremendous amounts of money at SAC and taken their money out, if the criminal charges go through, they will go to those people and have them cough up basically all of their gains over the last 20 years in that fund.
And this particular case has a lot of evidence that's been piling up. The criminal side of things, they've done things like wiretapping with warrants, obviously, where they've been listening to conversations and they've been reading emails, and it comes out very clearly that there was insider trading going on.
And that people were being hired specifically because they could do insider trading.
Yes, that they had relationships with companies that they were going to be investing with.
They called it an edge.
Hey, we've got a little edge. That's all it is.
Yes, it's just they were advertising for people with an edge.
Yeah, you know, my cousin's a blackjack dealer, and I give him a little bit of what I win. That's basically what they're saying.
Well, we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are y'all?
Good morning.
Thank you.
Doing well. How are you?
Okay, I have three questions, and I want to get your opinion, and I'm going to hang up and listen on the radio.
Okay.
Okay, first of all, is the stock market still undervalued? Okay, and what
all right,
do y'all
that's question one.
Okay, what do y'all expect for the stock market for the future, near future, months, years, and what could cause a major sell-off? I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen.
Oh. Okay. Those are some good questions.
Those are good questions because I got answers to all three.
Yeah. The first question is relatively easy to answer, and we've got all kinds of reference points that we can use. But most people would consider the bottom of the market in 2009 to be undervalued. I think that there's not very many people out there that would say, no, it was still overvalued in 2009.
There was one guy, Bill Gross.
Bill Gross was saying it was going to keep going down. Okay, most people, the vast majority of people that have a rational brain would say that at the bottom of the market, at the height of pessimism, the horrors of the depths of the market, that it was way undervalued. It has now recovered quite a lot since then. However, and this is quite important, earnings for the overall market have risen faster than the market has. Which means that the market is still, if you calculate for earnings, below where it was. Now you're shaking your head because I need to add in a point here. It has since then, since the point about 6 months ago, we were saying that the market at 6 months ago was less valuable than it was at the bottom of the market in 2009. Since then, we've had a run-up.
Mm-hmm.
But we're still nowhere near the value of the market before the drop in the recession. Nowhere near it.
Right. We have about right now the stock market forward price earnings ratio, which is the one we use, and that means basically how much money do we think they're going to earn, companies in the S&P 500 are going to be earning next year, and by the way, the estimates tend to be lower than reality. That is directly related to the fact that the a lot of analysts went to jail for inflating estimates, and that has a tendency to change their behavior. The ones in jail, particularly. But at any rate, it's running about, 14.95, I think, at the end of last month. The long-term average forward price-to-earnings ratio is 17 to 20. So the market is still undervalued. Now, but let's back up a step. The United States stock market is not one monolith, as a lot of people think it is. The large cap, the large companies in the U.S. stock market have run up rather dramatically over the last year and have run up to that point that I just told you about 15 times forward earnings, which means they're still undervalued, but they have, but they're getting close to their historic normal range. Now, at the same time, we can go down into other sections of the U.S. stock market, and we can also look at certain overseas markets and find them to be historically very undervalued. So when you say the market, we have to be kind of careful. If you're in large cap stocks, in other words, you're invested in an S&P 500 index fund or some fund that claims to emulate the Dow Jones Industrial Average or something, you're approaching normal. A, you're approaching normal valuation. B, those stocks might take, for no particular reason at this point, about a 10% drop just because the sun rose in the east that morning. And when we get to this level, that's not an unusual thing. So when we say, is the market overvalued or undervalued, there are certain aspects of the equity markets that are still rather significantly undervalued. Pretty much all of it is to some degree undervalued at this point. So there's a lot of potential for gain going forward. So, you know, we're kind of comfortable in that area. Second question, what could cause a sell-off? There's a real big one.
Yeah, there's quite a few big ones.
How about the House of Representatives?
Yeah, sequester is still a looming threat. I realize most people think that it's a non-event at this point because we've been in sequester and it's not that big a deal. We haven't noticed any huge changes, except that the changes that we've already noticed, the ones that we're able to measure, means that the GDP of the United States, the entire country, is down about 1.5% from what it should be at this moment if the government hadn't been making cuts. The big cuts start at the end of November, the beginning of October. The end of September, the beginning of October.
So time runs backwards.
Yes,
for you.
For me, I said November meant September. Anyway, so the big cuts, really, really big ones,
so
start.
Your calendar goes November, October, September.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do because that's the wrong way of doing it. Obviously.
So you're obviously made of tachyon. But anyway,
so sequester is going to hit, and the budget. Is not the only problem there because we also have a debt ceiling issue that's going to hit at the same time.
That is sort of a big one.
It's basically the same thing we talked about last year at this point with the fiscal cliff. The same big events that we just put off, we've got some pain that we've done for the putting it off, and we've got some bigger events that happen right in the middle of it.
To give you an example, you say a sell-off. Sell-offs at this point, because the market is undervalued and the economy, as we talked about earlier, in manufacturing and a lot of other areas, has a lot of momentum right now. So anything that occurs is unlikely to derail the growth in the economy, which ultimately leads to growth in the markets. The things that are short-term dangers, you'll remember, although that's a very long time ago to remember, 2011. People generally can't remember 2011. At the end of July in 2011, the conservative caucus in the House of Representatives took us to the edge on the debt ceiling. We reached the point where the Secretary of the Treasury was completely out of money to pay people, for example, so that the military did not receive their paycheck at the beginning of August. A lot of things happened rather quickly there, and at literally after the last second, the members of the House voted to raise the debt ceiling and kick the can down the road and then went home for summer vacation. Well, this year, the United States government technically right now has hit the debt ceiling. And the Secretary of the Treasury, the Treasury Department, is shuffling money around to pay the bills. Sometime late in the year, in the October-November time frame, they will run out of the ability to shuffle money. So sometime towards the end of this year, in the fall, we're going to run into another crisis. If the conservatives in the House stick to their guns and do what they have promised to do, in other words, if politicians do what they promised, which is sort of an unusual thing, but it does happen from time to time. Yeah, then
that's
we
about
could,
an understatement. That
we could get some pretty fair economic shocks, because the United States government spends a lot of money. As a matter of fact, it's the biggest health care provider. There's a whole series of things that the United States government is. And to suddenly have the United States government stop paying the bills for an awful lot of things and paying the companies that they owe money to would have a distinct short-term shock that would be very unpleasant and probably cause a panic in the market. Now, would it extend? I don't think so. And the reason I don't think so is the members of the House of Representatives, if they damage the economy...
don't get reelected.
horribly, they will go from the lowest approval rating of any institution in the United States to somewhere below that.
Yes.
And that means, by the way, right now, and there's one glimmer of hope in all of this, and that is a new record was broken by the Congress. They now have the lowest, not only the lowest approval rating since these things have ever been measured, but there's now a simple majority, I think it was 51.4%, that's what it was, mm-hmm. of the surveyed people in the United States, voters, would vote right now to replace their congressman.
That's pretty amazing. That's pretty rare.
And we've never had that before. And the House of Representatives is focused on getting reelected. That's survival for them. They might not create a crisis. Odds are if they do create a crisis, we will indeed get a complete turnover in Congress. I don't know. It's a distinct possibility. I've heard people around here talk about conservatives wanting to replace John Carter, who is the
head of the conservative, or secretary of the conservative caucus.
He's about as conservative as any human being can get and still be breathing, and that they want to replace him. And when I ask them why, they're just generally dissatisfied with him and Congress in general. That's very unusual.
Very unusual.
So we could easily see some positives come out of that in a weird sort of way.
Now, you also asked about our outlook for the future. We've just laid out some things that sound very negative. But if we look into the future a little bit, we don't have to look very hard to see that other than this, which is a pretty fabricated event when you think about it for a second, if you look at the growth potential that we have going forward, we've got a pent-up demand for automobiles, a pent-up demand for large appliances. We have a pent-up demand for computers. We have lots of cash on hand at both the corporate and the personal level. We have something completely amazing happening right now in the oil and gas world. It looks like we're going to be energy independent. We're not going to have to rely on people otherwhere in the world to give us...
Did you just say otherwhere?
I said otherwhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. Why come you don't like otherwhere?
I love that term. I've never heard it before, so it's
why
good.
Why come you don't like otherwhere?
Got that. You and Shakespeare.
And this idea that we will be independent as far as energy goes means that our manufacturing, which has, again, we were talking about this earlier in the hour, it is higher now, the amount of production that we're doing, than it has ever been. It's higher than it was before the recession. We're creating more products that the world is buying from us. Our exports are increasing. Our government debt is decreasing, which is a direct result of sequester. So short-term sequester might be painful in a lot of ways, but if we look at our overall, the things that we've been concerned about for a long time, debts and such of the United States, sequester is certainly not the best way to deal with it, but it's helping to deal with our huge debt.
Sequester is going to be painful, particularly locally, and I don't think it's going to go away. The budget ceiling fight is totally artificial because the same people, and I've said this over and over again, the same members of the House of Representatives who want to shut down the whole thing and do so, some really serious damage are the people who voted for the continuing resolution.
To spend the money in the first place.
To spend the money, and now when it comes time to borrow the money to spend that they said that had to be spent,
they don't like it.
And we've already committed in many cases to, you know, we owe people, the United States government owes people money. And if,
because they've done services. Congress said, do these things, we will pay you, but then we don't want to use our debt to do it.
And once we get past that, though, there's a couple of things that are really, really, really big positive. Jake was talking about how cars, washing machines, and so on.
Housing sales, you know, even.
When we look at the what are called durable goods in the United States, the consumer durable goods, people have had their washing machines longer. In other words, the average washing machine in the United States in a house is older than we've ever seen before. Well, there's two reasons for that. One, they make washing machines better. Secondly, people have held off purchasing them. Well, that's called pent-up demand. But there's another one that's just as big that I was kind of surprised to read about today. In 2007, the average corporate capital item, a capital item is something that they buy and they don't consume. It's like a machine.
Something they use for a long period of time. A big printer or something, or a copy machine.
Well, the average capital item in a corporation in the United States today is now 7.6 years old. In 2007, the age was 6.1 years. Well, what that says is,
we haven't been replacing it as fast as we used to, or we typically do.
And there is a little bit of a slowdown in replacement on high-tech items because they're lasting longer. They're working better. Cars now routinely go well over 100,000 miles, sometimes 200,000 miles, whereas before, at 100,000 miles, it was a piece of junk.
You had to take it on the backyard and shoot it.
So the point is that there's a certain amount of improvement in quality that lets us keep things longer. But there's a lot of evidence that there is still a very large pent-up demand. Unemployment is falling. The percentage of people in our economy working is rising. We're paying down our debts very nicely. So long-term...
And paying down debts nicely, this is on three levels. It's governmental, it's on the personal level, and it's on the corporate level.
And so... Long term, we're very, very, very optimistic. And I'm very specifically right now, we're optimistic in three areas, and that's mid-sized companies that are value companies. In other words, the ones that where they're worth more than their stock is. We're very, very optimistic about the future of generally what we call the emerging markets around the world.
Even though it's in a slump right now, we're looking at it and saying that is not going to continue.
Frankly, if the economy expands and does all the things that it looks like it's going to do, then commercial real estate is probably a good idea. But being very diversified in all of those is, I think, very, very important. So that's kind of a quick summary. And
now we're almost out of time.
So
but basically,
long-term
outlook is very, very good. Short-term, what do we expect the next couple of months?
Bumpiness.
We're looking at things. It's the same thing that we were talking about. We've been talking about for the last year. If Congress can get its act together, if the executive branch can get its act together, and they can actually do their jobs, do what they're supposed to do, pass bills that don't have bills that are attached to them to make them not pass later on, and that's really what's going on.
It's a big if.
There's a big if. Once we get through that, if we can get through that, we've been saying once we get through that for several years now, and we keep thinking, okay, well, they'll solve it now, and they just push it. They kick the can a little bit further on down the road.
And I also want to throw one other thing in there. I think the large cap stocks in the United States have probably gotten a little ahead of themselves. They're still undervalued, but they've risen a little too fast.
You're going to need a little correction.
Probably would not be a good idea to pile on to that particular run right now, but rather look at the parts of the market that are still rather significantly undervalued.
That part of the market that has become overvalued, there's another part of the market at the same time that became undervalued. Just look for that. And we're almost out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally. We're also a money management firm. Locally at 947-1111. You can leave a voicemail there. You can reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-PLAN. That's 1-800-914-7526.
You remember all those numbers so well.
Yeah, it starts with education in elementary school. They teach you numbers.
That's really cool.
You can also email us at jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com, or you can go to tpwc.com and listen to our podcasts of this radio program.
And next week, Lord willing, we'll be back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. Till then, have a good weekend.
TM, AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.